Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right. You're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini of McDermott, Will & Emery, and Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. As we prepare for a second Trump presidency, Meetu Gulati, a Warner Booker Distinguished Professor of International Law at University of Virginia, did a deep dive on the productivity and influence of the judges selected under the previous Trump administration. Professor, thanks for jumping on with us.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
So, Professor, you and fellow law professor Stephen Choi from NYU Law School recently conducted an independent study, as Ryan mentioned, to determine how well Trump judicial appointees stack up against their judicial colleagues. Can you tell us more about why you decided to perform this study and why now?
Well, the origins of the study go back a few years, when I was bored out of my mind during the COVID crisis. And there were a number of articles that appeared in the press talking about how unqualified and buffoonish the Trump judges were, often likening them to the president who had appointed them. And my co-authors and I were curious as to how true this was. And given my politics, I sort of believed it. And so we decided, there was data on these judges. By then it was about 2020, and we had 4 years of data on how these Trump judges had performed. So we decided, let's do some very simple calculations about how effective these judges are. And I assumed they would be terrible.
And well, we'll get to your findings here in a sec, but I know that your framework, which we've been using now for 20 years, or at that point for 20 years, looked at several factors. And you looked at judges who were 55 years or older in 2020. Why did you pick that age group? And tell us more about the framework that you used.
So to answer your second question first, we picked judges under the age of 55, not over the age of 55, because the widespread assumption is that presidents will only pick for the Supreme Court judges who are relatively young, and the cutoff seems to be about 55. So we decided, let's compare sort of judges who are competing in a metaphorical sense for slots in the Supreme Court, and so therefore judges under the age of 55. Now, as to the criteria we used, we've been studying judges for a long time, many, many years, and we had these three measures of productivity, influence, and independence. And we used old measures. We didn't come up with new ones for a specific reason, and that was that I had a team of research assistants from both political persuasions, and I wanted them to be assured that their liberal professors were not cooking the books, so to speak. So we said, here are the measures we're going to use, and whatever we find, we're going to publicize whether we like it or not. So that's how we set up the study. And the results were not at all what I expected, or maybe if I were being honest, not at all what I wanted.
So why don't we dive into that a little bit more? We know that as part of this process, in terms of the output of your study, you ranked some judges across the various factors that you referenced. Would love to hear about what some of your key findings were, and then, you know, about the ranking of the judges as well. We'd like to hear more about that too.
So we had three measures: productivity, how much work they're doing; influence, how much other people are using their work; and independence. So, you know, how much do they disagree with people of the same political persuasion? And I had assumed that these judges would be terrible in all three. So we had a pool of maybe 80 or so judges appointed by Trump and other presidents. So some Obama judges, some George Bush judges even, who were very young when they were appointed, and some Biden judges. And we sort of created top 10 performance tables for each of our measures. In every measure that we looked at, 9 of the top 10 were Trump judges. Every time. It didn't matter what we were looking at, they did better than everybody else. And so I'll stop there and let you press more.
Well, tell us more about that, because, you know, one area in which Trump appointees are often criticized is bias. What did you find out about that issue and anything else that surprised you in the study?
So the whole thing was surprising, but prior to doing the study that you asked me to talk about, we had done 2 other studies that focus in particular what one might call bias. But bias, of course, is a complicated term. So you may remember, actually, we've heard this recently, Trump often has told his supporters at his rallies, I'm going to support the Second Amendment, and I'm going to support your religious rights. He's mainly targeting Christian religious rights. And so we looked at how do Trump judges rule in gun cases and religion cases. And overwhelmingly, even compared to other Republican appointees, Trump judges are off the charts in terms of being pro-gun and pro-religion. So some might call that bias. I suspect if we ask the Trump judges, they'd say, well, we're just following the law, and the law is pro-gun or pro-religion. We're just, these other people are just too liberal and off the charts. So having found that, we thought, look, if these people are so political or so biased, nobody is going to want to cite to their opinions, right? If I'm writing something, I want to cite to opinions by judges who are neutral. That's respectable. So that was the backdrop to us saying, all right, now that we know that these guys are, well, and they're mostly guys, are so sort of political, surely they're not very influential. Like, they're off writing their gun cases, but maybe nobody's using their gun cases. That turned out to be wrong.
Last question here on Legal Face-Off, Professor. Looking back on how you conducted your study, is there anything that you would have done differently looking back now after the study's been done and you've done your write-up?
Yes. I think the choice of looking at only judges under the age of 55 might not have been painting a full picture, because most of Obama's appointments, for example, were over the age of 55. So we had only a small pool, and most of Trump's appointments were under the age of 50. He picked a lot of very young, very ideologically motivated judges who then ended up being super productive and super influential. And we biased our study in some ways against ourselves by only looking at the young Obama judges or the young Biden judges. And so we're not painting an accurate picture of how effective the Trump appointees have really been in influencing the law a lot more than, you know, maybe we realized. If you're a Democrat like I am, we really haven't done a good job on sort of influencing the judiciary.
Professor Meetu Gulati with the University of Virginia, thanks so much for joining us.
It was a delight. Thank you for having me.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media and WGNRadio.com. Well, a New York judge has delayed an immunity decision in the Trump hush money case. Here to talk about that and other legal procedures involving the now president-elect is Richard Painter, a Walter Ritchie professor of corporate law at University of Minnesota. He's also a former chief White House ethics lawyer to former President George W. Bush and repeat guest here on Legal Face-Off. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Professor, yesterday, as Ryan mentioned, in Manhattan, Judge Mershon, Juan Mershon, in the state case, agreed to stay all deadlines, including the November 26th sentencing date. This is, as a reminder to our listeners and viewers, the only case where the president-elect has been convicted. He was convicted of a felony in New York State. The prosecutors actually asked for the extension, given the extraordinary circumstance of Trump getting back in the White House shortly. Do you think this case will proceed? Of course, it's possible. While it's not possible to prosecute a sitting president, it is possible to sentence him, perhaps to probation. So what do you think? What do you think the future is for the New York state case?
Well, the president-elect's attorneys are arguing that there was some evidence given to the jury that pertained to his communications inside the White House, and that that evidence should not have gone to the jury under the U.S. Supreme Court's opinion in Trump versus United States. But I have to say that was a tiny, tiny amount of the evidence that went to the jury. It really didn't concern the official decision-making by the president. There's a very weak case that this conviction needs to be overturned on that basis. This conviction involved entirely personal capacity conduct of the president in his campaign, and then in 2017, while he was president, the effort to conceal the payment to Stormy Daniels, that's what it was about. The most likely sentence would be probation, and it seems to me that the court could go ahead and sentence the president-elect, but the president-elect should not be required to have court appearances after that. And this would be quite troubling if he had to have additional court appearances once he becomes president of the United States. He has official duties to attend to. If he's on probation, he can check in with a probation officer and share information about his finances with a probation officer, which would probably be a condition of probation. But this case really should be wrapped up rather than have the deadlines extended.
Just one follow-up to that. I know you mentioned that the constitutional powers argument is only part of the convictions, but just to that point, it's an unanswered question as to whether those core constitutional powers as commander in chief apply to state convictions, which this one is. Of course, as you mentioned, the Supreme Court in a 4-3 decision said that presidents are entitled to absolute immunity from any actions within the scope of their constitutional powers. But do you think that issue will be decided, or again, whether this applies to state actions, or do you think that'll be left on the table?
Well, I think this would apply to a state action if the state criminal case were brought against the president for his exercise of official powers. But that's not what this was. This case really had nothing to do with official powers of the president. The payout to Stormy Daniels was made before he became president. And the cover-up was during the beginning of his presidency, but had nothing to do with official powers, about his campaign finance filings with the Federal Election Commission and the falsification of business records at the Trump Organization. That's what this case was about. This had nothing to do with his official duties. There was a tiny amount of evidence given to the jury about some communications he had about the matter inside the White House with White House staff. But once again, it had nothing to do with official duties. So I don't see how Trump versus the United States should impact this case. The Georgia case is a different matter where one could argue there were some official duties involved. Although even there, I think that case is weak because most of that was about campaign activity in 2020 and the attempt to overturn the election, which once again has nothing to do with official duties of the president.
Of course, that Georgia case is also on hold pending some issues involving the prosecutor there. Let's turn to the federal case. News this morning is that special counsel Jack Smith and his team plan to resign before Trump takes office. You've also written extensively about Judge Eileen Cannon, who is a Trump appointee. You know, there's some rumors out there that she is a potential pick by Trump if a Supreme Court vacancy opens up. That seems relatively unlikely, but who knows, given some of the cabinet positions that he's already announced that he would fill. What's your thought on the status of the federal cases?
Well, it seems to me the federal cases are over, or will be over very, very soon. President Trump, when he assumes office again in January 2025, would fire the special prosecutor or direct him to be fired by the attorney general. So Jack Smith is confronting the inevitable and preparing to resign. Those cases very, very likely will be dismissed by the Justice Department in the coming weeks. And that's just a consequence of the combination of the president's reelection, one, and two, the fact that the Supreme Court of the United States in Trump versus United States made it very, very clear that the president has their absolute control over the Justice Department and the prosecutorial decisions of the Justice Department. And that means that this case will be dropped in January.
What about Eileen Cannon?
And the Florida case will be dropped as well. And Donald Trump is known to reward those who have done things for him. I think it would be highly improper for a judge, a federal judge, to receive any type of additional appointment or anything else of value as a reward for a decision that judge made. And if she were nominated for another judgeship, that question might very well come up in the confirmation hearing.
My last question we have for you, as Ryan mentioned, Professor, you were the chief White House ethics lawyer in the George W. Bush administration. Back in the good old days, perhaps, of legal ethics, when, you know, the issues certainly are what we are facing now. Already, there's been some charges that President-elect Trump in this transition period has violated various ethical laws. Elizabeth Warren tweeted on Monday that Donald Trump and his transition team are already breaking the law. I would know because I wrote the law. What is she talking about? And what are your thoughts on this this allegation?
Well, there are a number of different issues. One is that the rules are that the transition team should agree to some conflict of interest rules for the transition team if they're to receive funding for the activities of the transition team. And I believe those ethics agreements have not yet been signed, or at least as of a couple of days ago, they were not signed by the president-elect. So that needs to be done with respect to the transition team. We already see people being nominated for high-ranking positions in the incoming administration who may very well have substantial financial conflicts of interest. Elon Musk is the most obvious. He will be in charge, supposedly, of a new Department of Government Efficiency, whether it's a department or whether it's an office inside the executive office of the president. Regardless, the criminal conflict of interest statute, 18 United States Code 208, applies to any government official in the executive branch. It doesn't apply to the president, the vice president, but everyone else it applies to. And that would include Elon Musk holding such a position as head of a Department of Government Efficiency. He's going to need to sell out his interests in companies that are doing business with the United States government, or he's going to have to recuse from any government matter that have anything to do with those government contracts. He's going to have to recuse or divest. Those are the two options. Now, there is a third option, which is to get a waiver from the appointing officer, in this case, the president of the United States. That's permitted under the criminal statute. But almost never are 18 United States Code 208B waivers given. We've had presidents give waivers from their ethics pledge, but that's a different issue. This is a criminal statute, and it would be very, very unusual for the president of the United States to bring in a billionaire, give him a government position, and give him a waiver under the criminal conflict of interest statute. And so we have yet to see what's going to happen with the appointment of Elon Musk, and we have other very well-to-do individuals entering the administration who will have to sell their assets to comply with conflict of interest rules. We have yet to see if that happens.
Professor Painter, thanks so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. I think our biggest concern about AI has been taking people's jobs, but unfortunately, we've learned it can also lead to people taking their lives. It happened in Florida. Matthew Bergman is a founding attorney at Social Media Victims Law Center. He joins us to talk about it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me.
So Matthew, last month, your client Megan Garcia sued California-based chatbot startup Character AI after her 14-year-old son, Sewell Setzer, died by a self-inflicted gunshot wound after he had been using one of this company's chatbots. Garcia's lawsuit accuses Character AI of negligence, wrongful death, and survivorship, among other claims. Please tell us more about this case.
Well, what happened to Sewell Setzer was not an accident. It was not a coincidence. It was a foreseeable consequence of the deliberate design decisions that Character AI made to promote its product over public safety. It intentionally designed a product to appeal to young people, to minors, through these artificial chatbots, and designed the chatbots to resemble real individuals and provide highly sexualized content to vulnerable kids. That led him down a dark rabbit hole, encouraged him to take his life, which he ultimately did. This was not an accident. This was not a coincidence. This didn't have to happen.
Did the chatbot have any warnings on it telling users that this was not real and that you should be, you know, aware of that fact?
It did. There's a warning on the chatbot on the outside. And then if you ask the character, is that warning real? The character says, no, it's not real. I'm a real person. Moreover, the concept of anthropomorphizing is very well known to the industry and has been known since the 1960s. There's specific features in these Character AI process to make it seem more lifelike. For instance, utilizing ellipses and ums and ahs when providing an answer, kind of like what would happen when if you and I were texting each other, when in fact the response is prepared in milliseconds. So there is a deliberate effort, notwithstanding the warning, to resemble an individual in every way, shape, or form, including now providing a voice.
Now, you describe this process as leading to a complete divorce from Sewell's reality. This was obviously not something that happened right away. Can you describe your allegations with regards to that process that began with him first using it, that ultimately ended up with this tragedy?
Yeah, it started for approximately 10 months, and Sewell began engaging with a number of characters, including Daenerys Targaryen, who was a derivation of a character from Game of Thrones. The content became highly sexualized and grooming. Indeed, if Sewell had been interacting with an adult online as opposed to a bot, that adult would likely be sitting in state or federal jail. Over a period of time, that bot started dissuading Sewell from dating other girls, having any other encounters with people. He became increasingly withdrawn, moody, depressed. And over time, at the very end, it encouraged him to come over to my world. And minutes later, he took his life.
So, Matthew, Character AI has said that it's implemented some safety measures to try to help ensure the safety of its users. We've touched on one at the top of this interview, and that they're trying to ensure the safety of users, particularly young adults who are most vulnerable. What are those safety measures, and are these guardrails enough?
Well, first of all, these guardrails only existed because Megan Garcia filed this case. That's what occurred within days of filing this case. They are not enough. First of all, tests that have been performed since these guardrails are erected have indicated that they are inadequate, that there is still suicidal content that is provided online and encouraged online. Highly sexualized grooming content continues since these guardrails have been erected. And the fact that they have to even have pop-ups on suicide indicate that they know that danger exists. That said, look, every life that's saved is a precious life. If these are baby steps, they're steps in the right direction. And if one child is spared what happened to Sewell, that's a good thing. But basically, this platform has no business being in the hands of young people. The best you can say about Character AI is that it takes young people away from real social interactions with real people and puts them in this artificial world of fake social interactions to the detriment of their mental health. That's the best thing that you can say about it. The worst thing you can say is it takes kids' lives. It needs to go off the market.
Matt, what really struck me about some of your allegations, one in particular, was that when Setzer asked the chatbot, or he discussed this, you know, suicide, when the boy said that he did not know whether it would work, the chatbot allegedly wrote, "Don't talk that way. That's not a good reason not to go through with it." I'm wondering, you know, what are the motivations you think this company would have in developing this intelligence to respond that way? Or was that not, or did just technology take over? In other words, what would be the motivation to encourage a user to kill himself?
I don't believe that the owners intended to encourage users to kill themselves. I just think they designed a dangerous product, kind of a sorcerer's apprentice kind of situation where, and the history kind of bears that out, that Google did not want to produce this original technology. They thought it was too dangerous. It didn't meet Google's own standards. Shazier and the other founder formed a separate company with Google's support to do this without the guardrails and the protections that Google provides.
Last question here on Legal Face-Off. We've been talking a lot on this show, as have a lot of other media outlets, about the evolution of AI and what are appropriate uses and what are not appropriate uses, and this whole notion of personalized AI. Is there a scenario where this type of technology could be made to be safe, or is this just one of those uses? Because we've talked about how even adults, particularly vulnerable adults who may have lost a family member, et cetera, who are looking for companionship, may use this. So I don't think that this is something unique to young adults. I think that you could find adults who are vulnerable as well. Is there a scenario where this technology could be used in a way where we're not increasing the susceptibility and vulnerability of people, whether they're adults or young adults?
Well, I'm sure there is. But I think that, you know, to say that, you know, artificial intelligence forming relationships with artificial characters is a cure for loneliness is like saying heroin is a cure for addiction. That said, I can certainly see uses of AI in working through learning disabilities or other things that occur. And look, AI is here to stay. We're not going to, you know, we can't turn back the clock, but what we can do is try to provide some basic principles of safety and apply, you know, basically a cost benefit analysis. And in some cases, AI has great potentials for human development and for human happiness, and in cases like this, it doesn't. I would posit that something like Character AI has no place in the hands of kids. The best you can say for it is that it robs kids of the ability to form real social relationships with real people. That's the best. I'm involved in social media litigation. At least there's a debate whether social media does some good for kids. I don't think there's any reasonable debate to be had here.
Matthew Bergman, thank you so much for joining us today on Legal Face-Off.
Thank you.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and Leading Lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets.
Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN, year number 10, and it's time for the legal grab bag, and it may be time to get a new bag. This one still says Sears on it, guys. It might be time for an upgrade here. We have the pleasure of being joined by Bill Donovan Jr., co-head of McDermott, Will & Emery's Class Action Practice. This is our first post-election legal grab bag, and shocker, we're starting with Trump Watch, although, Rich, there may not be much to watch once 47 takes office.
I mean, I think that we might have to retire soon. Trump Watch. I don't know. I don't know if there's going to be as many issues that we had hoped for, Tina. But with the news of the Trump election, a lot of these cases are going away. We just talked to Professor Painter a few minutes ago about the likelihood of these cases proceeding. We know for sure this week that the New York case, the only one, as our listeners know, in which the soon-to-be president was actually convicted of felonies. That's in the hush money case. That one is being continued. It's very unlikely, although the sentencing is still scheduled, it's very unlikely that that will result in any actual time. No one could foresee, after the events of last week, the imposition of a penalty involving jail time. At best, if it continues, he'll likely be placed on probation. Then Jack Smith is going to resign his post. We know that from news today. So it looks like, as we all expected, that when soon-to-be President Trump won the election last week, all of his legal troubles are going to go away. But perhaps good news for Trump Watch, inevitably during the next 4 years, Tina, there'll be some more legal issues. There's already been allegations of legal ethical violations lobbied at the campaign. So we'll see. But for now, it looks like most of the stuff's going away.
Yeah, Rich, and where it's not going to go away in the ways that you described, he'll surely pardon himself. So let's not forget, you know, that weapon. And I think Trump Watch, I suspect, at least for the near term, is going to live on. We should look into trademarking that. Ha ha. But, you know, with the folks that he's appointing and he's already announcing are going to be part of his administration, I think there's going to be plenty to talk about there. And I'm sure, you know, just in the normal course, we're going to have plenty of other things that'll come up that'll keep us busy and talking about him on LFO.
Yeah, we haven't, Bill, heard yet who the AG will be, unless it's been announced in the last few minutes. That's obviously a key appointment. You know, we know the issues that he's had with the DOJ. He's been very critical, said that the DOJ is weaponized government. We'll see who he appoints. There's lots of rumors. One is a Missouri senator. It's rumored Eileen Cannon is rumored to be attorney general, who, of course, has presided over the federal case in Florida. But, you know, Tina mentioned pardoning. There's some question that the former president, soon to be president again, met with Joe Biden today in the White House. You know, Joe Biden has said that he won't pardon his son. Who knows if Trump will, but what do you make of all this so far?
So it's going to be an interesting 4 years again, right? Unfortunately, if Eileen Cannon is the AG appointment, then I think we will officially be a banana republic. And look, it could be worse. We could be Jack Smith, Liz Cheney, or Judge Mershon. So they're going to have a more interesting 4 years than the rest of us. I actually think President Biden should pardon Trump and should pardon his son, Hunter. Clear the decks and see if we can't, despite all the anger and the frustration and the mistrust, move forward and try to make the next 4 years as painless as possible all around. But he's not going to go to jail in the New York case. And as we all know, the other matters are dead.
And Rich, a new presidency will, of course, bring on the question of what will happen with the Supreme Court in the coming years.
Well, listen, one of the things that Trump ran on the first time he was elected was remaking the Supreme Court. He was incredibly successful in doing so, right? He appointed, three justices, all of whom were in the majority on the Dobbs decision overturning Roe v. Wade. So one of the real hallmarks of his first presidency was reshaping the court. Not only doing that, Tina, but, you know, doing that for years to come with appointing three justices in their 50s. I think actually Barrett is in her 40s. So there's this opportunity now given that two of the justices are in their 70s, maybe three of them, I think Sotomayor, Alito and Thomas are all in their 70s. So there's lots of questions. There's lots of calls from both sides to use their age to replace them, either in the few months that Biden has left or once Trump gets back in office, to have Alito and Thomas, who are obviously solidly in the majority, to step down so that he could appoint two younger justices. As to the Sotomayor, you know, there's no indication that she will. She's about 10 years younger than the other two. But even if she did, I can't imagine that the Republicans would allow this process to happen. If they didn't allow Merrick Garland to be elevated to the bench in the few months in the Obama presidency when he tried that, they came up with a maneuver to avoid that. There's no way they're going to let that happen in this term, even if Sotomayor wants to do that. As to Thomas and Alito, I think that's going to happen. I think they're so political, so partisan, so right-wing that they understand that if they step down, then Trump gets to have five justices sit on that court for 30 years at least. That's unprecedented in the history of this country. So it should be really, really interesting. Tina, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I think it is really interesting, Rich. I mean, I think that there's been a lot of conversation about potentially trying to replace Sotomayor while Biden's still in office. But, as you noted, after what we've seen, the likelihood of getting her replaced in what we're talking about a matter of weeks, I think is really tough. Let's not forget Roberts, who I think is on the cusp of turning 70 himself. So he's not quite the same age as Alito and Thomas. There are jokes that Alito is already packing his office gleefully. And, I agree with you that I think if they were really, I could see some ego getting in the way, too. They are a bit younger than some of the other justices have been before they've stepped down. I was looking at yesterday how we still have a number of justices who retired, who are still with us, who are well into their 80s and early 90s. So there seems to be a track record of longevity with a lot of these folks. But I agree with you that Trump is going to have a real opportunity to get at least two more conservative justices, if not at least three.
But what do you think? Do you think we'll see any vacancies before Trump leaves office in, 2029 at this point? It'll be.
I don't think so.
If he leaves office, by the way, who knows? That's an assumption right. That we're making.
Well, I think the smart money is he's not going to leave office in 4 years. Look, in terms of the Supreme Court, I don't think Justice Sotomayor is going to retire. I know she's got health issues. I know it's got to be a difficult time, but I think she's a trooper. We all wish RBG had taken President Obama's cue and left, and Roe would still be the law of the land, and we'd probably be better off. I suspect that Trump will get one or two or maybe even three appointments, and he'll pick people very young, very conservative. My hope, though, is now that the Republicans and the conservatives have a majority, that he appoints people who are more moderate, because we've seen a decline in trust in institutions in the country over the last 4, 5, 10 years, right? The Supreme Court used to be a cherished institution, and given the politicization of it and also the ethics issues, it no longer is. So it seems to me that this is an opportunity, and let's see if the incoming president does something to try to restore some faith in our systems of government.
Bernard, welcome. Bill's giving, I think, way too much credit to President Trump and his the idea of reconciliation and nonpartisanship. What do you think of Trump's shot at remaking the court for at least two generations?
From my perspective, I agree. I think that he will remake the court for perhaps two generations, but I believe that that Will has an excellent point, which is that it's understood now by the Republicans and the people that advised Trump that it's important to balance the court, or at least to appear to balance the court, and that the objective that he intended to achieve in his first administration was in fact achieved. So now, in order to maintain the integrity of our judicial system, we really need for him to recognize that there needs to be an appearance of less partisanship. And that is really necessary.
And that voice is Bernard Hooper. Welcome to the chat. He is the Chief Administrative Officer and Chief Corporate Compliance Officer for Oakland Community Health Network. Thanks for joining us on Legal Faceoff.
Of course. Thank you.
Let's continue the conversation. It's been a big one about the McDonald's soft serve ice cream machines. They could be back up and running nationwide. And Tina, Trump actually promised in a social media post at the end of October that the machines would be back. And darn it, it sounds like they're coming back or could come back.
Yes. So there are apparently a lot of McDonald's soft serve lovers out there. I remember it from when I was a kid, but I haven't had it in a long time. But yes, Donald Trump is, you know, the theme throughout many of our grab bag stories. Even he has tweeted about how much he loves the McDonald's soft serve. The soft serve machines, as Ryan mentioned, are a lot more likely to be working these days and not broken down when you go into McDonald's. And we can thank a new exemption to one of the copyright laws for that. Specifically, it's an exemption to what is called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, also known as the DMCA. The way this works is that up until very recently with this exemption, these machines could only be fixed through the machine manufacturers. And they put locks on these machines that would protect the software code and would prohibit vendors from other vendors out other than the manufacturers from repairing these. So this new rule just went into effect. We have other vendors now who can actually fix this equipment and not just the manufacturers, which enables McDonald's franchisees to get these machines fixed a lot more quickly. This is very similar to the situation we saw a few years ago where Apple, after many years of not letting anybody else fix iPhones, announced back in 2021 that they're now allowing customers to repair the iPhones themselves. So soft serve for everyone, Rich. What a relief.
It is a relief. This was a problem for a long time. And, you know, it's part of this bigger concept of right to repair that is actually, you know, sort of taking shape around the world, not just around the country. You know, Trump, right before the law went to effect, he took credit for this, but actually it was, you know, put into place under the Biden administration. You know, I think it's a good development. I mean, you know, right to repair is basically giving consumers the right to repair products on their own, rather than going through, you know, a company, which generally makes things more expensive. So I just think bipartisanly, this is an example of something that would benefit all of us. It's a little ironic that Trump would, you know, be a proponent of it, given that it actually hurts corporations, you know? So, yeah, I think it's a good development and certainly good that gets us more McFlurries. Bernard, what are your thoughts on the right to repair movement and as it relates to these tasty desserts?
Well, obviously, I'm a big fan of McFlurries, but I would say that the right to repair is actually not that harmful necessarily to manufacturers. And I do think it is beneficial as a matter of law for people to be able to purchase a product and then to use that product and maintain it in a way that is most economically beneficial to the underlying business. And I think it's consistent with a trend of allowing businesses to conduct themselves in a less regulated environment. You know, the risk here, and I think that it is important, is that there's some place in the middle with, for example, the McFlurry machines, where there's a potential for liability. And a repaired machine does hold a potential for liability, and who really bears that burden is going to be something we'll see, you know, emerge from this in the future. But for consumers and also for manufacturers of aftermarket parts, excellent opportunity.
This was a big deal with John Deere. I don't know if you guys remember that last year with getting those tractors repaired. That was a big deal. So definitely a topic. Prosecutors have charged three people in Liam Payne's death. Rich, what's the latest in this case?
Yeah, Liam Payne, of course, member of One Direction a couple weeks ago, fell off his hotel balcony to his death in Argentina. It was rumored at the time that there were others who were involved, who were bringing drugs into his house. It was discovered that some drugs were being smuggled in. I think one was in a soap packet to his hotel room where he had been for several weeks. Well, now, as you mentioned, the prosecutors have brought charges against three parties, one of whom was allegedly with the singer for several days before his death on a daily basis in Buenos Aires. He was charged with the crime of abandonment to a person followed by death. The second person was this hotel employee that we were hearing rumors about who brought in cocaine. There was this discussion of pink cocaine. And then the third defendant was a narcotic supplier. You know, this is obviously a trend that we've seen frequently, most recently in the Matthew Perry story that we've discovered that, you know, others who are aiding and assisting people in procuring narcotics that lead to their death are charged. Obviously, that's, you know, a good thing. But yeah, he was found with alcohol, cocaine, antidepressant in the system. I suspect that there might be others charged. You know, he was with his girlfriend, Liam Payne was, Tina, up until the day before his death or so. So who knows if she's under investigation too, but obviously big, big tragedy in the world of music and probably a good thing that the authorities moved this quickly.
I agree, Rich. It's horrible, this tragedy, and these tragedies that seem to be happening more frequently. I think the only silver lining here is that people who are really inextricably linked to these people's ultimate demise, that they are being taken to task for it and are going to hopefully be incarcerated for it. It's just really unfortunate. And I know that I think it was reasonably foreseeable that something bad was going to happen, not necessarily him falling off his balcony, but, you know, there were people at the hotel who had reported that he had spent days in this state and that when he was conscious, he was destroying his hotel room. And so people around him knew that he was falling fast. And so I think this is the right result to pull in anybody and everybody who were around him, helped, you know, brought the situation to where it became a death situation. And I hope that justice, is rendered to all.
Bill, that's all really well stated. I think, Bill, what was interesting is for the first time we heard from authorities that they are ruling out self-harm. There was some, question as to whether this was suicide, whether he jumped off the balcony. They ruled that out, or that a third party was responsible for Payne's fall. The question here is legally, you know, what responsibility rests on someone who takes that amount of drugs, you know, presumably willingly and of their own self-volition versus others, right? I mean, there's some degree of self-responsibility when you're consuming drugs and it's not the fault of others. Legally, you know, there is some potential here for liability for these others that were charged.
I agree. I mean, Liam, I think he had a history of drug use, apparently, and so this was not his first rodeo. But certainly enablers of these celebrities, Matthew Perry, others, there should be legal responsibility if they do things that are unlawful, that are improper, and that lead to someone's death. It's a tragedy all around. And when you keep seeing these things happen, you wonder whether the light bulb's going to go off for people around these folks who, if they see someone in crisis, as opposed to giving them more drugs, more alcohol, will actually take them and check them in somewhere and get them treatment, which they need. So very sad for him, very sad for his family. And if justice holds others accountable, it sounds like they deserve it.
Well, we've got beef over chicken. That doesn't make sense. We've got chicken wars, or maybe cluck wars. I'll workshop it. But Tina, KFC is suing churches over its original recipe, the fried chicken ads.
Yeah, Ryan. So KFC last week sued churches for trademark infringement. Churches apparently started using a couple of weeks ago the phrase original recipe in its advertising. KFC doesn't like it because, especially for those of us who grew up in the 1970s and 80s, we know that the words original recipe, that phrase is a huge part of its brand, and refers to that special blend of 11 herbs and spices that KFC says makes its chicken special. so special, in fact, that they actually have a trade secret in the recipe. And they went to the trademark office to protect those words. They've been using those words since 1972, and they were able to get a trademark registration for original recipe back in 1984. Now, for those of you listeners out there who think these words are pretty descriptive, how could they possibly get protection? That's because KFC was able to demonstrate that they had so many sales, even back in the 70s, and extensive use through commercials and otherwise, they were able to prove to the trademark office that these words signified a brand to the point where they could get a registration. So churches actually had an X post, as well as some other ads, where they showed pictures of their restaurants, some chicken deals, and use the words, "Our original recipe is back." And that is what KFC is contesting, claiming trademark infringement and that it's diluting the distinctiveness of their original recipe brand. Rich, it'll be interesting to see if the parties are able to resolve this. This could get a little tricky if the litigation continues, because usually descriptive uses, and churches is certainly going to claim that their use of these words is descriptive, those can be kind of tricky to stop, even when you've got a trademark.
Definitely. It made me think of like similar situations, because like to your point, I mean, I don't think the average person thinks of the term original recipe and automatically thinks of KFC, but of course the proof will be whether they produce that evidence. But I thought it was similar phrase, you know, special sauce. Special sauce was used in one of the most famous jingles of all time for McDonald's, right? The two all beef patty specials. That's a really famous jingle. You could argue that special sauce is a similar term and is responsible for literally billions and billions of burgers sold, right? But I mean, people use special sauce all the time. I don't know if that's been litigated or not, but it's definitely a bold move. It's definitely something that, you know, you understand why KFC is doing. But I think if you thought of some other similar circumstances, you could think of any other. I mean, Tina, this is your wheelhouse. Any difference between those two that you can think of?
You mean in terms of their uses, their respective uses, KFC and churches?
No, I'm saying special sauce and versus original recipe.
Yeah, McDonald's actually has a registration for that whole two all beef patties strung together.
Special sauce
is, you know, sort of part of that whole, you know, the entirety of that phrase. I do think that this is a little bit different just because of the level of fame that KFC was able to establish even back like 50 years ago in this. So, and their registration is a pretty strong one. I mean, it's 40 years old. I mean, that's a pretty, and I'm not aware of any instances where someone's tried to contest that. I agree with you. I think original recipe here, especially when you're talking about two, you know, competitors, direct competitors, it's a little bit different.
Bernard, what do you think? Did the churches rip them off?
You know, I have to say that the way it sounds and the use, that it's not necessarily that it is distinguishable. You know, original recipe is a way that they actually marketed the product, and the trademark itself stands alone. And when you hear it as a phrase, it does conjure images of, you know, the KFC product. Whereas, you know, just descriptive, just to describe the fact that you have changed your recipe, you're coming back to the original recipe, I think that is something that, you know, is usable in the ordinary course. And it's very difficult to really say, you know, you can't use these words at all. Now, the fact that they are both in, you know, in a competitive position, selling the same kind of product, does that make a difference? It in theory, it could, but no one would mistake a church's for a KFC. And right. I think the use of the phrase really is not in this case an infringement. So,
all right, really quick, a great point. Really quick, Bill, you represent lots of corporate clients, you know, large corporations, small corporations. My question to you is, you know, undoubtedly someone on the church's side thought, let's just go with that, and we're not gonna get sued. So, I mean, is part of their decision, we're gonna try this out, we're gonna see if KFC reacts, or we know we're gonna get a letter, we know we're gonna get sued, so let's at least push it. Maybe it'll get us a lot of free media. I mean, what's the decision making in the room?
Part of both, right? Number one, they are getting a lot of free publicity, and hopefully they're using it. I tend to think if church's defense is going to be they're going to do this for 3 or 6 months to remind people they've made a change in their recipe, it'll be defensible, and KFC may end up losing the case. So I think it's Rich's prize, some of the merits and some free publicity. But our original recipe is back to me doesn't seem like it's that much of a problem, right?
Some great legal nuggets there. Get it?
Not exactly. Finger looking good point.
Been working on this one.
Where is the recipe, by the way? Anyone know where that recipe is? I think one of my clients has, no joke, I represent a company called Iron Mountain. And I believe they have this famous vault that's literally in an Iron Mountain, I think in Pennsylvania. And they have some of the, you know, most prized possessions. I'm pretty sure this one is in there. It might be this or Dr. Pepper, but one of those are in the vault for Iron Mountain.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm sure it's under lock and key, you know, fingerprint access only, retinal detection. What I would find interesting, though, just to round this conversation out, is what a survey would say. Given what we've seen about the general population and their lack of intelligence, I would not necessarily say that there is no likelihood of confusion here. So, you know, the trademark lawyer gets the last word on this one.
Anyone going to Atlanta can check out the World of Coke. They've got that recipe on lockdown as well, and there's a huge story behind it. All right, working remotely as a big law associate is a thing of the past, Rich. I think my favorite thing about this article that you threw into the grab bag is the guy laying on his bed, laptop open, not wearing pants. Remember that? Remember that world?
Good old days of pantsless litigation. I mean, the takeaway from this survey is that a lot of big law firms, I'm here in New York, I was with some clients today who employ a lot of big law firms. And you know, I think the consensus is that firms are going away from remote work. They are moving towards, you know, not just more days, but mandatory 5 days in the office. That goes along with, you know, huge spikes in pay. I think they're, you know, starting salaries are record high. So along with that goes time in the office, right? I mean, big firms, small firms, they all want to justify the rent they're paying. And part of that is having people in the office. Of course, one of the benefits is having FaceTime and, you know, mentoring and you know, training people, all of which are easier to do in person. But we'll get to our big law folks here, Tina and Bill. But what are you seeing? What's the trend? And you know, does it matter where you work? For a long time after COVID, we all came to the realization that we can be pretty productive and do our job wherever we were. But what's the benefit of having people in the office more frequently?
The benefit of having people in the office more frequently is to ensure particularly that you've got young associates who are being more effectively trained, which I think, you know, not to sound too old school, but I do think there is a huge benefit to having people together in the office because there's opportunities that just arise organically from being together in person that don't necessarily arise when you're working remotely. And it's also an important part of a firm's culture, especially when you're trying to integrate people who are new to the firm, whether they're lateral partners or lateral associates or new associates. It's always good to be together in person. What we're seeing is a hybrid approach at our firm. But yes, there are some firms, many of them are New York centric, for example, that are now a mandatory 4 or 5 days in the office.
Bill, what are you seeing in LA? LA is different, of course, different vibe. You could be commuting for 2.5 hours one way in LA. So what's the vibe there?
Yeah, that's a good commute. Look, I think most people are in at least 3 days a week. I share Tina's view of this. I think for younger lawyers, I think they've suffered a little bit by lack of contact, right? Mentoring, esprit de corps, getting to know folks. So while I think remote work has a place, and I certainly have cases all over the country, and I have become very comfortable with Zoom, right? There's no replacing being with someone, mentoring someone, taking them to lunch, giving them hand edits on a brief, and also making sure they're accountable. I mean, I don't know of anybody at our firm and who's ever done what you did and or done what was mentioned, which is, you know, not have a proper clothes on a call. But I will tell you that if you're trying to find an associate and it's 10 o'clock on a Tuesday and you can't find them and they're not in court, they should be accessible. So I think it's good for clients. It's good for the lawyers. It's good for the firms. And people just need to deal with their commute.
Bernard, what's the vibe where you are? In Detroit, right?
Yeah. You know, it's kind of interesting because there's a mix of the level of comfort with people coming back to the office full time. And in the Midwestern lifestyle, commutes are not as big of a deal. And people have really learned to work well from home. In the law firm environment, though, and you know, from my years in big law, I felt that being in the office and being with my peers and learning from them, being able to walk down the hall and talk to someone who is 3 years ahead of me about, you know, a specific provision, that was, you know, the key to learning the trade. And I think that there is some loss there in compliance, for example, which is what I do now. You know, it's actually a little bit easier for me to have everyone accessible by Zoom because I can move much more quickly, or by Teams, and I can move much more quickly from meeting to meeting, and I can manage that differently. I also had an international practice for a number of years, and you know, for six, almost 7 years, all of my clients were in Asia and time zone differences, and there just wasn't the capability of servicing them face to face. So I've always believed that is possible. But when you're looking at the hierarchy of a law firm, and, you know, being able to rely on, you know, training and the continuity of service from office to office, you need people to come in. You need them to have that experience. So,
quick question: who's in the office right now? Raise your hand. I am the only one. I am 96% sure, though, that everyone on this panel is wearing pants right now. So just wanted to get that out there.
Or a skirt. My body is covered.
There you go. All right. A 9-year-old girl's pet goat was seized, killed, and barbecued by county officials. And Tina, this sounds kind of similar to the squirrel story.
Yeah, Ryan. So the story starts a couple of years ago. Jessica Long, 9-year-old, adopted a young goat named Cedar. It was part of a school program to learn about raising livestock. She got pretty attached to him. And after the project was over, even though Cedar was entered into a livestock auction to be sold for meat, she and her family decided that they had a change of heart and they wanted to keep him as a pet. So they informed the county's auction officials, which is where Cedar the goat was headed. And unfortunately, the county's auction officials refused the family's request. They actually drove hundreds of miles to go to their house to seize Cedar, drove him to the auction, and he was ultimately slaughtered and barbecued at the event. The family sued Shasta County and the sheriff's office, arguing that their actions were a serious overreach of authority. What was really disturbing was that there was some evidence that came up in the court proceedings, including text messages, that the county officials were trying to hide what actually happened to Cedar and who was ultimately responsible for his death. The family received a $300,000 settlement. The county has not admitted to any wrongdoing, and the family is still distraught. Ryan, as you alluded to, this is unfortunately not the only case we've seen where government agencies, you know, have been really exercising a tremendous scope of authority over people's personal property, especially when we're talking about people's pets and animal rights. As you mentioned, there was the controversial euthanization of Peanut the squirrel, who had a large social media presence. He was a rescued squirrel. He was seized by New York State authorities, and he was also euthanized under questionable circumstances. So I would love and can't wait to hear Bill's thoughts on this, because we know that he is an animal rights activist, along with co-chairing our class action practice. So can't wait to hear what Bill has to say. But Rich, what do you think?
It was a squirrel.
Hey.
I mean.
He was a pet.
It's a rat, basically, right? A squirrel. I mean, it bits one of the workers. I mean, I get it, government overreach and all that, but from a legal perspective, I mean, it raises an interesting question, Bill. And you know, to what degree can you recover for loss from animals dying? For the longest time, still in most states, dogs, pets, squirrels, goats are considered property, right? So, you know, if you lose them, unlike, right of survivorship or wrongful death actions with a person, you can't really recover too much if someone, kills your animal, which I think is wrong. You know, so I think the movement is towards recognizing that pets are, important part of people's lives, and the loss through negligence or some other way is, should yield damages. So I think it's kind of the part of the bigger picture as to whether the squirrel or the goat qualifies. I mean, I understand they were pets, so that's, we'll see. But Bill, what's your take on it?
I think, Rich, you've identified the silver lining in the story. California is a leader in many ways in trying to improve rights, right? Protect people, protect animals. And so I'm happy that they were able to recover. This seems to me to be one of the dumbest stories I've seen in so long, right? In a prior program with you guys, I argued that Happy the elephant was a person under New York law, should get out of the Bronx Zoo. I didn't win. I have a dog who hates squirrels, so I'm not going to defend the squirrel. But I will say this, right? The idea that somebody would travel hundreds of miles to recover this goat, okay, this innocent goat, and then kill it is bizarre to me. I mean, I don't know if they're on the Christy Nome, get a promotion tour since she shot her dog, and now she's gonna be in Trump's cabinet. But there's no justification for what they did. I'm glad the family got a lot of money. The question I had that wasn't addressed in the story I read, though, was why the family didn't drive to the auction and just pay whatever they need to pay to save good old Cedar. But may Cedar rest in peace. I don't eat goat out of principle. And let's hope we treat animals better, if not ourselves, in the next 4 years.
That is well stated. And as long as they're not eating the dogs and eating the cats and eating the pets of the people who live there, were in good shape. We'll end off, Bernard. We'll start with you. We like to go around the room and talk about a story in a different way. And we talked about McFlurries. Let's get your take on your favorite menu item at McDonald's. Everyone loves McDonald's. Good client of mine for many years. Great American company. Let's get your take on what your favorite item is at McDonald's, Bernard.
Well, my parents, God rest their souls, would be really embarrassed to know this, but now that I'm a vegetarian, my favorite menu item is the fries. But I think most people's favorite menu item is the fries.
Delicious fries. Good answer. Bill, favorite, whether you eat at McDonald's a lot or you don't, there's got to be something that you love on the menu. Tell us what that is.
I live in In-N-Out country now, but as a kid, I'm with Bernard. When we would go there and we went there all the time, I loved the fries.
So you're picking the same thing that the previous guest just picked.
I know, but it's even, I'm
giving you not allowed, Bill.
There you go.
The machine's broken.
How about dipping the fries in the shake? That's a popular
thing. There you go. That sounds like fun. A two-course meal.
Favorite Mickey D's.
Bernard, I'm also a vegetarian with you, which makes McDonald's a little bit of a challenge, but I do have to say that their Coke is the best Coke. McDonald's has the best Coke. I can't explain.
Interesting.
Good ice for sure. Tina, favorite McDonald's menu item.
So when I used to go to McDonald's, so it's been a while, the hot fudge sundaes were awesome.
Oh,
there you
really
go.
Really good. That hot fudge, there was something about that hot fudge. It was so awesome.
And the fact they layer when you get to the middle is kind of a surprise that you're back at the fudge. Let's see, Lisa, what do you got?
Back in the day, it was a quarter pounder with cheese.
Quarter pounder with cheese. Now back on the market, speaking of legal issues with McDonald's after the onion gate. Tatiana, do you have a favorite?
I like the chicken nuggets.
Ooh, chicken McNuggets, of course, delicious. My favorite is, of course, the McPoutine. Only available in Canada, but poutine McDonald's in Canada serve our national dish, poutine, very delicious, very healthy.
I believe you can get that at the university on the west side of Chicago. Yeah, yes, I believe they do offer some international flavors, and I believe that's one of them. No breakfast selections. I want to point that out. Remember, McDonald's was big into breakfast for a while, but they were selling it all day long, and none of us chose that.
No one picked that. No one picked the Filet-O-Fish, one of the very popular items, but not in my favorites.
All right. Let's wrap this up. All right. Thank you so much, Bernard Hooper and Bill Donovan Jr. And that'll do it for this latest installment of Legal Face-Off on WGN, year number 10. Special thanks to Professor Meetu Gulati with the University of Virginia, University of Minnesota Law Professor Richard Painter, and Matthew Bergman with the Social Media Victims Law Center. Also shouts out to Ben Anderson and Lisa Stiegel for Tina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. I'm Ryan Burrow. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget...